Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy!
Our Thoughts Tonight.
Welcome back, everybody.
Hello, hello.
We are here. Ashik is here.
Hello.
Zach is here.
Howdy.
And I am your host, Alex Trebek.
Authenticity for 500.
Today. Authenticity for 500 today on Our Thoughts Tonight. What is our topic this evening?
So our thoughts tonight are about, well, it's kind of broad, kind of specific at the same time. Authenticity, reality, simulation, basically keeping things real, whatever that means. So if you want to go all hardcore postmodern on it, go for it. If you want something more like simple technology, that counts too. So basically authenticity.
True self.
True self. That, you know, what's real? You know, what is real, I guess. This is a broad topic. So, you know, if you guys have thoughts that connect with that, you know, it'll connect here. So,
of course, I think we're all in one way or another are familiar with the concept of authenticity, even if it's not on a philosophical level. Like, everyone's dealt with like somebody being disingenuous or something of that nature.
Man, you're saying a bunch of words that are too big for me to understand.
It's really funny. Funny you mentioned that. There's a line in the book that I read in preparation for this podcast that has something to do
how to read Braille?
No, not a book. In preparation.
You go to Braille and Latin at the same time?
No, there's an event in the book that I'll mention later that has something to do with very much the daily life and facing fakeness. But again, everyone knows fakeness, you know.
You can see it.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
With some people.
So before we get into authenticity, as always, crucem sanctum.
Crucem sanctum subit.
And we're back with our thoughts tonight.
Before we get into the topic, I did want to bring something up. What do you think about the exit from Afghanistan and how that's going and the Taliban taking over?
I think that Joe Biden did three previous president's jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
We're having the same conversation as like a decade ago, like with Obama in Iraq. It's like, you should have never gone out. It's like, well, eventually you gotta, and the longer you stay, it's gonna screw. And again, the Taliban haven't, you know, it's not their first time controlling the majority of Afghanistan.
Been sitting and waiting.
I mean, yeah.
Like they've been waiting. They've been sitting and waiting for Americans to pull out.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I mean, well, the Taliban already started their offensive months ago. I mean, I guess you could say that the leaving was contributed somewhat, but it's like at the end of the day, they already started their offensive. They were already sweeping through southern Afghanistan. Yeah. Like they were, you know.
And the Trump administration signed the agreement, which released 5,000 Taliban. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard of that, but I'm sure.
And I'll fact check that. But if I'm not mistaken, that's what happened. And after that, I mean, we're talking about people that were held in Guantanamo Bay for years. They're going to want to go back.
Yeah.
And another thing that Trump said, actually, that I heard him say, and again, I'll fact check this, but I'm pretty sure he's right about this, even though I'm not pro-Trump, I'll give him credit for this, is that now the Taliban have access to all these Black Hawk helicopters and all this military equipment left behind. And I saw footage on Reddit yesterday, and I don't want to confirm this because I don't, you know, anything can be falsified.
Yeah.
But, you know, footage of Taliban with like very modern stealth gear, you know, modern like DARPA developed like, what do you call it? Night vision goggles.
Yeah.
But, you ever wear those?
You know, no, I want a pair, honestly. They're so cool.
You gotta find them.
I love tactical gear. I'm a nut for it, even though I don't agree with it. But I don't agree with military stuff, but it's so cool.
Yeah, because it's fascinating.
I've been coming to the realization that I'm hardcore propagandized because like I was a Cold War child. I mean, pretty much. Even though the Cold War was over in 92. Growing up in a nuclear family, I was looking through some old photos of my childhood, and it looked like, even though America, you know, wasn't communist, we were influenced by the Cold War, and you can tell by the photos. It's like very raw and brutalist.
That's what they say about the 90s is like, it's basically like the depression after the Cold War.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like the, okay, Soviet Union's gone. Well, what now? You know, it's all dark.
On the surface level, you have this this Clinton administration saying that everything is okay. Now we're in the beginning of advancing neoliberalism.
Would you call that a black swan?
The
end of the Cold War?
End of the Soviet Union? Absolutely a black swan. Nobody
and everyone
predicted
saying
it.
That it's okay and like it's all fine. So.
Yeah, they're rationalizing it. And like the thing about like a huge nation state breaking apart like that is that it can be predicted to some extent because you can see the downfall slowly, but you don't know when it's going to happen because there's so many factors. Well, and the only people that about, if you look in the history, that came close to predicting it was the CIA. And they didn't start predicting it till about 89. And we're talking about that's the CIA.
Well, see, that's the thing with the end of the Soviet Union, though. A lot of the events that cause this downfall, at least what most people say, were very like in the immediate, like Afghanistan didn't happen so much long before it actually fell, and same with Gorbachev, and that stuff was almost like it seemed like I mean I didn't live during that, but it was like a whole union falling apart immediately, and by immediately I mean like 10 years or so, but like you can't, it's really hard to trace that, like I don't know, 30 years before that, like you said, if the CIA predicted in 89 that's like
2 years
because
the intelligence, you know, that you would have never guessed because it's such a massive, you know, situation that would happen. But you know, if you're internal, you know, that's where hypernormalization comes from. You know, the Adam Curtis movie, he gets the name from a book that written by this Russian sociologist, I believe.
That's so weird because the author that we're kind of going to delve in today had something called hyperreal.
That's
where I thought
hyperreal.
Yeah.
So the hypernormalization is like everybody in the USSR knew that the system was falling apart.
Yeah.
But everybody was just going along with it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's where we can get into the idea of authenticity.
Yeah.
And this was inauthentic as hell.
It's funny you mentioned that because I was actually going to connect the Afghanistan war with... See, so the author that I mentioned earlier was is Baudrillard and stuff. John... What was his name? Baudrillard.
John Paul?
Yeah, I think it was John Paul.
Let's get this right. Hold on.
John Paul?
Yeah.
John Paul.
So he actually wrote a paper or something called The Gulf War Never Happened, right? And I didn't read it or anything, but I knew what it talks about.
I heard about this, actually. Yeah. I know about this, and I haven't read it.
Yeah.
But also, Adam Curtis is very inspired by him, and he did something on it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is basically like it was a televised war, and I forget the exact thing the paper goes for, but it was basically a televised war, and it was never really a war against Iraq. Iraq was basically the same right after the war. The whole thing was was directed towards the concept of war. I mean, the guy kind of has a conspiratorial mind in this paper, I think, but basically that it was against the idea of war, which is the most real of all things. Now you can see the war on TV, right?
Yeah.
And I think you can kind of say the same with Afghanistan.
It was also, as John Baudrillard.
Baudrillard?
Totally butchered that.
Weird name.
Sorry. But
John Baudrillard.
Another thing that went into it now, if I can remember correctly, is that in the Adam Curtis documentary, he talks about how that war seemingly never happened for a lot of people because there was this new form of warfare where the RAND Corporation had devised, you know, like data mapping of where the person was.
Yeah.
The person across the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And the tanks would just point and shoot. So you didn't feel like you were killing anybody.
Yeah.
It was just tank warfare, but you were killing people.
I mean, drone warfare now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was also giving these people, like warhawks, incentive, or not necessarily warhawks, but people in the military, incentive to be more willing to kill because they weren't seeing the damage they were doing. They were just like, look, we're hitting people and we're advancing.
It's like number crunching.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned
it. It's a different perspective too.
Yeah.
It's like you don't see it from the people that are on the ground, you know, like maybe you do, but you got fucking horse blinders on.
Yeah.
Essentially, you're not seeing all the damage that's done where the blinders
are. Because if you did the psychology, you know, you would get
PTSD. You'd have to, like, PTSD, and have all these other fucking things running through your head, like, wow, this doesn't seem right with me.
But that's what they go for, though. I remember I actually just watched a video of some guy. It was, like, some random funny YouTube video of, like, some guy just infiltrating an arms dealer convention, and it was pretty funny. There was a guy in there, and they were testing out these, like, new suits or something for warfare, and the guy afterward during the interview was like, oh, yeah, it makes me feel like a machine. I don't feel human. It's good for the detachment from the actual warfare. It's like, this is something that people are going for.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It's like, you know,
how do you make war less like,
yeah,
war?
And of course drones are part of that too. So it's like, this like hyper real stuff is like, it's extremely real.
Can you explain Baudrillard's theory of hyper reality? I don't think it's his theory, but just for the listeners.
I mean, I think I can go off the cuff of what it is, I listened to an audiobook recently of it, and I wasn't paying too much attention, but I got the gist of it. The whole idea is that you have certain events or certain concepts or whatever. Most of the time, it's usually some sort of technology that helps various things get more inauthentic, right? So I guess to start off, things start off in the early modern period and in the Renaissance through copying whatever, right? So if it's reality, if it's a sort of like event happening, they paint it, right? Or they write in a book, right? So they represent these things and they copy it. They basically copy reality, right?
Does it change at all in each copy?
Yeah, it doesn't change.
Does it evolve?
In the beginning, it doesn't change. It's just a direct...
I'm saying each time, though.
Well, eventually you get to that point. So that would be something in another stage of this development. But it first starts out with authentic copying, right? So, for example, you have a movie that's supposed to represent something in reality, right?
Okay.
But it's supposed to be a copy. And then through a sort of growth in capitalism, you eventually have these products being more and more, they're more like commodities at this point. They're so widely copied, there's the actual value of the original object, whatever that was, is less valued,
the
right? The inspiration is diminished as you have, like, so for example, you may say,
the more copies of something that you have that is one,
the meaning starts to lose value completely, right? And then finally you have the hyperreal, which is what, like, Baudrillard is most famous for, or like his simulation and simulacra and stuff, where basically you have things that have no actual reference in reality, right? Yeah. So it's kind of post-apocalyptic.
What would be an example of that?
So that's actually a great question, because I think people...
I was reading about it earlier, but it was like in the middle of the day, so it's escaping me.
See, I've actually asked that question myself, like, what's a modern day example? And I think people are split on what actual examples are. So the perfect example is this, and it's kind of a crude example, but I think it was the perfect... I was watching a lecture on this, is... virtual reality porn is probably the most number one example of this.
I've seen it before, boys.
Where it's is direct.
Not myself, I
would have picked a better example if I knew one.
I should know a little bit more about this because it's related to psychology. But
he mentions conditioning and like he references behaviorism like constantly.
I pulled up a couple examples of examples of hyper reality. So it says. And this is just a quick Google here.
Yeah.
A sports drink of a flavor that doesn't exist.
There you go.
For instance, wild ice zest berry.
Mm-hmm.
Like just some weird random Gatorade.
It's like...
So it's supposed to reference berries, but there's no berry in it. It barely tastes like berries.
Oh, here's a real mind fuck. A plastic Christmas tree that looks better than a real Christmas tree ever could.
Yeah. but that's the real gist of it. When the fake thing is better than the real.
Yeah.
So like, for example, video games or whatever. There was a lecturer talking about this, but he's like, when I was talking to my kid and he was like yelling at his game machine because it's like a thing from the 90s.
It's a simulation.
He's like, why are you so angry at the machine? He's like, and apparently the kid looks at the guy. And he's like, what are you talking about? It's like, and for that split second, the game, being angry at the game was more real than real. Like, of course I'm going to be angry at the game. I don't have to be angry at a person.
I think all of us have experienced that. The game rage or whatever.
Yeah.
Like when you're playing something and like, I feel like it's because you get so invested.
Yeah.
But if you were to have a
machine,
like 0.25 seconds ago, you were freaking, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Fine. I remember when I was a kid, I was playing Skyrim and I looked out the window and there was a bird and I thought it was a fucking dragon. And I was like, and that's the thing. Let's like we can even extend this to, like, politicians, right? And he talks about this a little bit more in a different way. But the way I was interpreting it was like, or at least the way I would have interpreted it was like, if you, let's say you have a politician who's supposed to represent the people, at least in America, that's very much different. Where they're more like independent actors, independent entities that do what they want, right? Yeah. And they're supposed to represent, that's what they're voted on, but in reality, they're more like, they have no original source in the reference. They're just acting what they want. That's the way I interpret it, at least. And that's important, because that's hyper-reality in our politics, you know? And I think I think hyper-reality is in everything, really. But
I was going to ask for both of you guys, what is the allure to hyper-real entities? Or they're irresistible, seemingly. Like these weird Gatorade flavors that don't really exist, or the Christmas tree that looks better than a real Christmas tree.
Simplicity. I think it's an excuse, like an easier way out. Like, if you went and cut down your own fucking Christmas tree, there's a lot of work that goes into that. Yeah. You got to cut it down. You got to put it on your car. You got to carry it home. You got to plant it. You got to put it in a thing. I've done it.
Yeah.
And then you got the one where you pull out of the box underneath your basement and fucking fold out the branches to make it seem real. But it looks just as good as the original.
Yeah, why bother, right?
But
there's
also the instant gratification.
It's instant gratification. It's just like...
there's neurologically
I feel like
a
there's,
better response when you actually go and chop the tree
That's
down.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, I feel like, for me as myself, I would get more satisfaction... You know, I would get more amped up to do something like that.
But historically speaking, that's not how human society has worked. I mean, the mere advancement of technology means people have favored simpler solutions. I mean, Baudrillard...
Of course they have.
Well, that's the whole point. That's the whole point of technology.
And let's simplify this shit. Like, if you had a huge equation, right? And then on the next... They do this, like, maybe not the next one, but the next question after. Mm-hmm. Fucks with your head. But you second guess yourself.
Well, that's the whole point of... Pretty much what humans do. Like,
I know, but why do you want to simplify it?
Well, that's just easier. It's simple as that. Yeah, and like Baudrillard actually goes into this, and he doesn't actually view hyperreality as like apocalyptic doom. He actually views it as incredibly euphoric. The entire purpose of all this is euphoria.
Yeah.
You drink that weird flavor because it just tastes good. It might be better. You put up the fake tree because it is easier.
It's easier, or it's unknown, or like.
And obviously, the satisfaction of making chopping out your own tree is good, but like,
it's a pain in the fucking ass.
Yeah, no one's gonna bother. Like, there's a difference in value within the aesthetic and with the actual work.
A lot of these things have come around. Let's say the Christmas tree.
Yeah.
Not so much the Gatorade.
Yeah.
But the Christmas tree, for instance.
Yeah. Whenever you say the Gatorade, I think of two things. I think of in Sharpie, like. Whatever, like on the Gatorade, like freeze, none of those.
What I was saying was, so there's like a few reasons that come to mind for me that why hyper-reality or hyper-real situations like the Christmas tree or like Las Vegas or things that are more instrumental, like instead of having to chop down the tree.
Visually.
You can get the fake Christmas tree. This is a great example of it. Let's use that because... The hyper-real serves a purpose in, I can't chop the tree down right now because I have to be at my job.
Yeah.
So it's tied into the capitalist nature of having to either mentally or actually physically be doing something related to your job or your profession or whatever capitalist addiction you have.
Keep the ball a rolling.
Exactly. Snap, because you don't have time to fucking cut a tree.
Yeah.
Fold out some branches and stick it in a stub. And
These websites, these apps, like instead of like the Wall Street Journal had an app called Wall Street Journal City, which was essentially a condensed version of the normal Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Except every article, the most important articles were whittled down to one page.
So they're basically summarized.
Summarized.
I mean, that's short.
Because you got to get back. You got to get back to your office.
Yeah. Like, tell me the facts. Let's go. Yeah. Let's wrap this up. I got to go.
I mean, what you said with the whole like development of capitalism thing is like spot on. Because like, you can connect that with the more desire for quick utility, the increased value of aesthetics. You know, for example, right? And I actually. When I was reading the book, I ended up like, you know, I just drank a little bit and wrote a paper on what I thought was cool. The thing is, you could really stretch hyper real and references to literally anything, right? So and what argument I made was like, you can really draw it all the way back to like agriculture, and maybe that's the inner Unabomber in me or whatever. But it's like you can really view it as, you know, beginning of civilization. You make the farming to substitute. The traditional nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyle, right? Yeah. You start, you know, you start changing
your
methods.
Make your life authentic.
Yeah, and you start, you know, it's supposed to be a reference to food gathering, but you get more time eventually with civilization and stuff.
Yeah.
And eventually you have more time to do other stuff. It's not just capitalism, but it is that capitalism definitely sped up the process and the Industrial Revolution. But you eventually start...
You're missing out on like the human interaction.
Well, exactly, because you choose things that are in some way or another better, right?
That's the most authentic thing that you can see firsthand in life is children at play.
Yeah.
Because they're not really aware of everything going on around them. They have an understanding.
Yeah.
But they are authentic in their personality and who they are as human beings, and they're not changing because anybody goes. But as you get older, I feel like you put a border up and you're more afraid to express like your thoughts and how you feel or your emotions or whatever, and you're being whatever your surroundings want you to be. Your
I mean,
job
in a way, you know, rocket I mean? Back like, me up, it's like conditioning
yeah,
you have at
to.
Some
yeah,
point.
You're conditioned at some yeah. point where you're obligated to do yeah. those certain things.
Yeah.
I'm like, holy fuck, my eyes a lot. I was like, oh, that's cool.
I will say this, though. Like, I for example, like, you used to go to Turkey, or when I do something that's like more naturey, I suppose, it's like, it feels like you're entering. Yeah. It feels like I'm entering a completely different world where it's like, it's genuinely more alone, but in a good, authentic way.
Yeah.
It feels more natural, you know, or, you know, more authentic because there's so much less of this, you know?
Yeah. Structure.
Yeah. So it's weird how it even affects like how you feel. I don't know. Happy Real's real. Yeah.
A lot of the things that are in our modern day, like you mentioned, the VR porn.
Yeah.
But not just VR porn, but this new...
It's VR in general, yeah.
The VR porn and other types of pornography.
Yeah.
And I don't want to come off as anti-pornography because I don't really know.
Yeah.
But I do know that there are a lot of, like, watched a TED Talk the other day where there were a couple studies done on people, college students from this current age, so about 20, your age, I guess.
Yeah.
So people that grew up from, you know, Gen Xers, essentially. Yeah. That Gen X. Have all, I'm sorry, Gen Z. Yeah. So people that have always known a high-speed internet connection for the most part in their conscious period of their memory.
Captain Crunch PC, dude, 1997.
Yeah, so those kids have always known high-speed connection, are familiar more so with this high-speed porn with 4K resolution, et cetera, et cetera. And just
and
even more geared like algorithmic pornography too.
Yeah,
you know, it's geared for you. It's made to make you, you know, interested in it. So you come back for more or whatever.
Yeah.
So those kids versus a control group, which they apparently had a very difficult time to find a control group because so many people watch porn. That group of Gen Z kids versus like a group of millennials from my age group, they asked them to stop watching porn essentially. Mm-hmm. So a cessation of a sort.
Fuck.
And they realized that the kids that were your Gen Z, it took them longer to get over the depression, the anxiety that was caused by the pornography, largely, than the people that were millennials that weren't exposed to it as long from such a young age. So you can look at the Gatorade of the wild colors.
Yeah.
And whatever it is, you know, like ice berry, whatever it was, I can't remember. And you have to think that that has an effect on somebody's reality too, because it's an environmental effect. But what effect does that have? Like, we don't even know what a lot of these things affect will be. And we have yet to determine that.
I mean, at least in regards to the drink, like, not only, you know, I don't know, chemical, whatever reactions, but also like, I guess also the actual feel of it, like, you know, a difference between like your Minute Maid orange juice and like just freshly squeezed orange juice.
Yeah.
And maybe the difference is so small. I mean, that's the whole point of the Hyper Real, but it's like, I'm sure there's some sort of difference, you know?
You see them like with McDonald's burgers and such. They taste good. Yeah.
Pink slime.
High sugar, which actually sugar is evolutionary.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people, until they form a palate, don't like bitter things because the sweet sensation meant that it was like a fruit of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So it's evolutionary response that we like things with sugar, even if you don't taste the sugar, like in a McDonald's burger.
Yeah, but the thing with like, you know, process, you know, what's that one thing called? In vitro meat or whatever, like the new meats that are, you know, not meat, but kind of meat at the same time, right? Like they have their origination, I think, in somewhat with like pink slime. And when pink slime was going on, people were disgusted by it because like, that's not food.
Yeah,
but it's
like the McNugget juice, right?
Yeah, but in a way, you know, it wasn't, it's supposed to be, you know, imitating meat or whatever, or it's supposed to be more ethical for animals. But like, we're immediately disgusted by it because it's, that's not real food, you know? I want my food, you know,
and bleeding. Does pink slime have health effects, bad health effects?
I know we researched this a little bit in my ethics class last year, and I think it was, I don't think there was, as far as I know, it was fine. Either way now, oh God.
Zach just poured himself a glass of wine and I'm going to post it on our Twitter. You got to see. It's
never mix.
It's fattest glass of wine I've ever seen.
And I can imagine you at the server.
If someone came to my house, it's like, hey, can I have a glass of wine? I'd like give them a fucking coffee mug of wine.
I would give
them a glass.
Or just give them the bottle. They're like, hey, pour yourself whatever. Yeah, but no, I get it. But we serve out of these, like, you know, the serving amount. So when you pour that much, it's just looks hilarious. 4 second pour.
Yeah.
In case you guys hyper remember. Real.
Yeah. There you go.
We should take a quick break.
Yeah.
Okay. Break time.
We'll be right back.
Hyper real. Welcome back, everybody, to Our Thoughts Tonight. So our topic is authenticity still. We're talking about Baudrillard and everything. And Zach got a question for everybody.
When someone says authenticity, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Rod, do you want to go first? Authenticity.
Authenticity, first thing that comes to my mind?
Yeah.
Like just the first thing that pops into my mind?
That's when really someone hard. Says like authentic or authenticity or something.
That's hard.
What's a first? What's a glance of what you would see in your head?
Lemmy.
Like the first thing.
Is it Lemmy?
That's the first thing that honestly came to my mind was Lemmy.
Or human.
Humans?
Yeah.
Humans. I disagree with that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like when you see them physically. Like
so like literal physical human beings.
Yeah. Okay. We don't know. We can't tell like the difference between, according to Baudrillard, we can't tell the difference between simulation and reality. So we don't even know for real.
That's true. Actually, what he would say, actually, it's probably like human is an outdated term. Or society or world are outdated terms. They are human? Real things, but we don't deal with the real anymore.
Are we not human
anymore? I mean, we are. Yeah, but
this conversation has taken a turn.
Yeah,
it seems. I wonder why. Yeah.
Well, I will say. Well, really quickly to answer your question, I think what came to my mind was books or whatever. But in terms of that question, I think he would probably say humans are real, but I think the way we view humans is not real. We don't view humans as humans. We view humans as something else, right? And maybe you can even view, like, you know, back in the day, you could say, okay, people didn't view other people as humans. They viewed them as like their races. We view other people as their careers now. That might be another example of like.
No, I don't know nothing.
Whatever is most euphoric to you is probably the true hyper real.
I want to bring this back for a second to the Taliban and
that's funny.
ISIS.
Yeah.
Mujahideen,
yeah.
And yeah. Also Al-Qaeda.
Boko Haram.
So Baudrillard also says, I haven't read, this is apparently an essay,
yeah,
but I haven't read the essay yet, but I read the Spark Notes, but I'm so intrigued by it, I'm definitely going to go back and read it.
Yeah, Baudrillard's like the perfect, like, sociologist, philosopher guy.
Totally. Thank you for showing it, by the way. But what he says about groups like the Taliban is that it's not necessarily the aura of death that surrounds them that's what makes them powerful.
Uh-huh.
It's the symbolism of torture, if I'm not mistaken. Let me pull it up here.
That sounds like something he would, yeah.
Okay, huh. So it's Baudrillard sees the power of terrorists as lying in the symbolism of slaughter, not merely the reality of death.
Huh.
And I think that's super powerful and incredibly, like, maybe it's easy to see for a lot of people, but for me, I would have never thought about it.
I mean, you can view, like, you know, for example, American soldiers kill, but they're not really viewed for, I guess, the death, I suppose. You're viewed for whatever else reason. Terrorists do the same thing, but instead, like, I guess it's more viewed in slaughter.
Yeah, well, it might not even be, because you can look at it in a point of view of, like, what are we seeing?
Yeah.
What do we see when we watch United States government military?
Uh-huh.
So you see the soldiers firing. You don't see the other end of that.
Yeah.
But with the Taliban, you see the only footage they have where either they're sitting around or they're literally stabbing somebody through the chest or beheading them.
It's always about perception
management of what we're presented.
And that gets pretty harsh. Like, I think with the Gulf War example, that's where I was going to. With the Gulf War, I think, and this part of a lecture on Bojira, so it's not exactly in the book, but I think it was like an example of a certain footage of the certain bombing or something in the Gulf War, and it was apparently shown constantly on CNN, so it appeared to be that it was constant shellings, where in fact it was just a single shelling that was a precise strike or whatever, but it appeared to be constant warfare, constant engagement by U.S. soldiers, but in reality it was just one random shot out of this one instance of the war. So it's whole editing and stuff, so it's like this the hyper real was, I suppose, constant warfare in this period, in this war. But reality was just like this one-off shot.
If you were to watch something like Jimmy Fallon or some talk show or some shit like that, it's a formula. It's scripted to a degree. It's like watching an episode of Friends, but you enjoy it. You enjoy it to a certain degree, just like with any acting or any movies or anything like this. But what if we got authentic fucking view of like the making of, you know, like when you're making music, you don't pay attention to it, you're in the moment. Raw TV shows.
He talks about that. He talks about the interest now is not just movies, but how the movies are made, and also like reality television, right? Yeah. So like Ice Road Truckers, it's supposed to be real, but it's not. Or like the making of this movie by this guy.
That shit is why you have to buy like the extended DVD version to see all those things.
But he talks about how that stuff is even worse, because that stuff is not only hyper real, but it's pretending to be real to so much to an extent where even authentic things like the making of a movie
are fake. But that's the point,
man. Well, you look at...
But that's the norm at the same time.
Well, yeah, that's what you would agree.
That's the weird thing.
Yeah.
It'd be better to see it in an authentic point of view than...
Well, that's the trick, though. It's tricking you with the authenticity.
At the same time, I also enjoy it.
No, that's not controversial. Of course, everyone enjoys like stuff like that. Yeah.
These things, like Conan O'Brien. The problem I see, I think Bailey and I were talking about this the other night. The problem isn't necessarily the propagandist. It's the people receiving the propaganda that don't think critically. That's the problem. Because you can inoculate any propaganda if the person across... Well, to a certain extent. Some propaganda is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
If it's ahead of its time. But, like, if you watch CNN, you're like, wow.
Yeah.
What the fuck? These people are just...
Then you got to throw in the factor that it depends on the network.
Or I'm going to come off sounding conservative if I only call out CNN.
Yeah.
If you watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News.
Definitely that one, yeah.
Or any of those main big dog news sources.
Yeah.
You're like, what is this? You know, and the transatlantic accent, for instance, or I think it was not the transatlantic accent, whatever accent the news anchors use. I think it's called, like, there's a word for it.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody could look it up. So that accent.
Jamie, look that up.
It's like a news anchor. You know how they talk? Like this. Oh, yeah. And when you get the news, you get it from a guy that sounds like this. Yeah. And if they especially tell you to trust that news source, you should be afraid. Because that, what is that voice? And actually, Sartre talks about this in a way.
At least on Google, it just says a general American accent, but slightly slower than a normal cadence. I mean, there's definitely a specificity to the accent.
Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, we always know,
Okay. Anyway, Sartre talks about this in a different way, where I'm me now, as the guy. This is my purest form is, you know, I'm next to my wife and two of my closest friends. Yeah. But when I'm serving...
Like, yeah.
That is not necessarily me when I'm serving. Yeah. I have trouble doing it because it's incredibly inauthentic.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't like serving these people.
It's a front,
but the societal necessity to be like, hey, how's it going today? How are you? My voice goes up a pitch.
Yeah.
That societal necessity after paying attention to it is incredibly hard on me. And I have what is like a constant jabbing existential crisis every day.
See,
I would just like to insert to this conversation as somebody who was assigned female at birth that women go through this in more than just our jobs. You know, we go through life this way, like every single fucking second. If you're not using a voice that's higher pitched than your actual voice, people are going to think you're like a bitch, you know? So like, let that rot.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's awful. Terrible that you have to do that in situations, not just waiting on tables.
But I feel like some effects are more cultural, I suppose. Like, yeah, no, but like, I feel like some things are a little more cool. Maybe not so much with a voice pitch, but like, I don't know. I keep thinking of like Nietzsche and stuff, like, you know, the evolution of morals and stuff like that. So it's like, for example, if our high pitched voices right now are in accordance with like submissiveness or politeness, that might have been different before, where let's say the proper way was something else, lower or something like that. So it's like, It's I think it's probably a bit of both. There's definitely some genetic stuff going on, but I think cultural stuff as well.
I noticed that. It's like,
the reason why I'm saying that is there a parallel between the person that's the server or the news anchor? Because news anchor is to some extent in our society a career, because it's some bastardized form of journalist.
Yeah.
And server is a server. So you get into these other dynamics where it's like submissiveness versus a power situation.
Yeah.
And then there's a, you know, because journalism is a certain form of power.
Yeah.
But there's this theory, if I could remember this too, I can't remember it. And I can't remember who it was by. It was a psychologist. Anyway, there's necessarily like three motivations. Three core fundamental motivations to everybody's behavior. One is the desire for community. The other is desire for, I think it was health or something like that, of some sort. And the other is a desire for power.
And that is, those are all contradictory in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but everybody in one way or another, based off of everything they do.
Yeah.
They just want people to come together.
Yeah. But, you know, they overlap with people, but there's a dominant.
In a different way.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you, when I ask you what is inauthentic, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Oh, there you go. So, Shatara.
Patriarchal white supremacy and the power structures. Because that's what I wanted to tie it back to. That's what I'm realizing I was going to say, is that when we're talking about a server, you know, like demurring for a table, or we're talking about news anchor, you know, like putting on a voice or it, whatever it is that they're putting on, I feel like what we're talking about is power structures that are inherently patriarchal or white supremacist. And because of that, like, you can carry it down. Like, you know when, like, I don't know, this sounds like a stretch, but I tell you what, it is factual. When I see it in my life, it all makes sense, because I think that it's somewhat of a servitude gesture to go up to a table and raise your voice a couple octaves, you know? Yeah. And so because of that, it's inherently a service thing. There is a definite carryover. It is what a long time ago white men preferred. And so therefore we're all doing it, you know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, it is pretty fucked up. Yeah.
Is it like,
I was going to say two things about, one, the patriarchy, and two, the whiteness. So I'm going to start with the whiteness at first, I think. I was like recently, it was like some random YouTube video, but like, he was talking about basically the concept of whiteness or whatever, and how it's not necessarily viewed as like a race or a color or whatever. It's more like the lack of one, right?
God damn, son.
I mean, that's the thing. I think when we talk about whiteness, it's less about race or whatever. It's more about, I don't even want to say culture. It's like, for example, I think, like, I think he made this review. Well, yeah. So like, I think, for example, you know, someone might say, you know, but you know, white people have culture, you know, my German culture or something. And that's true, right? But I think there's a distinction between, but there is a distinction, I think, with the way whiteness is used now and the way it's been portrayed because of the history behind it, is because of its lack of connection to specific cultures. For example, like, you have German cultures and stuff. You could even argue specific white cultures aren't white.
No, it's like,
because the whole idea is that whiteness is a lack of it, right? But that's the thing.
There's the evangelical, now detached kind of modern megachurch, which is based largely, there's that one book, I think it's like Jesus and John Wayne. Have you seen, it's like a bestseller right now.
Oh my God.
I started reading it. I read the first chapter.
Oh Lord.
She just named it Jesus and John. and it would have sold.
Jesus and John Wayne.
Yeah.
Or John Lennon.
That's what I would have thought of.
The whole John Wayne is significant. It's not just a bullshit title. Because John Wayne is significant to the theory because that a lot of this like ruggedness that with modern socially conservative megachurch evangelicism is largely based around the archetype of like the cowboy and the ruggedness and the natural, you know, mentality. And that's detached and that's hyper real in a way because cowboys were never like that. They were depicted in John Wayne films like
that. Everything that makes it cool about that situation
so is postmodern.
The fucking what's it called? The weed that goes across.
Oh my! I know it's
tumbleweed. Thank you, Bailey. It's the tumbleweed that blows in the wind across the desert. As the wind blows by. And then it's
cool
got that
part.
Sick fucking delay guitar. It's like doom 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 doom.
People have seen that and gone the wrong. So this is why I was saying like propaganda is so powerful. Exactly. So it's like propaganda of that nature that people can't see through. Like imagine when the John Wayne movie first came out and you saw it. And you lived that. So like James Bond for me, like going back to the Soviet childhood in the 90s, or not Soviet, sorry, the Cold War childhood in the 90s in Alaska was very, very, very influenced by the Cold War. So I grew up watching James Bond movies, wanting to be an agent for the Empire.
Yeah.
And now I'm trying to apply for the FBI. Like that isn't an accident. You know, so imagine these people that grew up watching John Wayne movies got the wrong idea. Now we're in this detached form of evangelicism. Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
But John Wayne is awesome.
Yeah. No, well, I think, I mean, that's that hits a lot of marks. The one thing that I was thinking about was like back to the whole cowboy it's thing like maybe I'm viewing this in a different way, but at least, for example, like John Wayne movies or something, to me, it seems more like a creation of culture rather than pure imitation of what actually happened. You know, but that's obviously the truth of that.
Yeah, it's a perception management of how they've received it.
But I think in a way, I think the movies actually might help in, I mean, this goes by the whiteness, maybe in creating a sort of culture. Because like, ideally, when you look at like, creating, you know, the cowboy movement or whatever, or like, you know, in the 1800s, the whole idea was to detach from society or to make a new life. And even that mere idea of detachment and going out west and manifest destiny, well, manifest destiny in itself is very like, holy crap, you know, whatever, you know,
multiverse,
what's the word? Whiteness, whatever. Whiteness. Right. But the whole idea is like, it's supposed to be a detachment.
He says whiteness.
Can we, wait, can you go back to manifest destiny for a second?
Yeah. So
I think a lot of people don't know what that is.
Manifest destiny is just the belief, in early America. And I guess nowadays too, maybe there was a religious divine need to get more land. So like that was
America,
westward expansion.
It.
And once we ran out of land, we had to buy Alaska. We had to conquer Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Cuba, all
that
stuff.
That's what I'm talking about.
But yeah, but it's stuff like that. That's where we start talking about like whiteness or whatever. Because in a way you can say like, okay, you have this, you know, this system that is inherently trying to escape the way the world is. It's literally trying to have a divine reason to be better than everybody. Right. So it's, and again, then at that point it goes beyond culture and starts creating its own new culture. And this is going back though, and this might be changing a topic, but I actually do want to go back to patriarchy as well. Because like earlier I mentioned the whole agrarian revolution and like how that's also that's all hyper real stuff. A lot of people tie back patriarchy to the agrarian revolution, right? The mere fact that once you start settling down, and then there's becomes divided roles between men and women, that's where the patriarchy really starts from. So eventually, you know, the woman becomes the primary, she becomes solely responsible for the household because, you know, the man goes out and makes whatever, right? But eventually you have farming and that makes more free time, not for the woman, but for the man, right?
Why? How does that
Well, because he doesn't have to go hunt anymore, right?
Oh, okay,
so you start from a physical difference. Okay, you know, the guy will go and hunt and the you know, and then his wife or his partner will you know.
Hold on. Let's take a detour real fast.
I'm so excited to hear the rest.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
I'm sorry. Have any of you guys ever been hunting before?
Never.
No.
I've never been hunting either. But have
I've been
you,
fishing.
Like,
but
let's just wrap this shit up real quick. Have you guys ever wanted to go just for the experience?
Never.
Maybe midway.
Never.
Kind of, maybe.
Like
not to kill an animal, but to just shoot a bow
not
or
like
something.
To
yeah.
fucking kill a giant. I don't like killing animals.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I said.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, damn. Why do I want to shoot guns at the same time?
Aesthetic value but versus like, utility value.
That's what I'm talking about. But there's like, if fucking Costco
Ted Kaczynski, power process.
There is a Walmart down the road.
What's right and what's wrong?
If there is a Walmart down the road, yeah, and you don't have to go kill a fucking wild animal, there's no point to it.
Is that why people go for those reasons?
No, they go because it's one of those three things that I mentioned. It's a desire for power, very clearly.
Dude, I mean, literally, like, I hate to be that guy for like every episode of this podcast.
I'm just curious,
but like, literally, power process from Ted Kaczynski. It's literally like it seems to be referencing what you said.
Yeah,
with a need for power, and it connects again with the whole thing.
Are you talking about Kaczynski, right?
Yeah, because his entire thing was power process. People don't go hunt because it doesn't, you know. Because there's ease of Costco or whatever.
And now it's more acceptable, not necessarily acceptable, but it's almost like more common, you would think, to hunt other people.
I don't get the urge to like go hunting and go shoot.
Because you don't need to. Because
I don't need to and I don't want to. Like, I have no urge to do it.
If you did need to, you would feel like, oh shit, I got to go out and kill something because I'm hungry.
Like us working here, we're like, okay,
we're satiated.
But that's the thing, though. That goes back to the whole thing that I was talking about, patriarchy, right? With the agrarian revolution
or authenticity.
I mean, it's probably both, or a lack of authenticity. But the thing is, like, it's just classic agrarian revolution stuff. You basically have more time to do anything else when you don't have to hunt, when the food is provided for you. But that's really important, though, because eventually you start getting into things, and this is more Kaczynski, I suppose, where you supplement that need for whatever with something else, right? So whether that was, you know, art or like blacksmithing, music, whatever.
I'm talking about like ping pong battle.
But the thing I was saying, though, with the whole patriarchy and the agrarian revolution, when you have this whole concept of more time, the person who's going to get the more time is the guy, right? Because whether through biological reasons or whatever, like the woman will never have that opportunity because she wasn't the one going out and hunting. The guy was. And so when you don't need to do that, the guy can focus on whatever, and that will eventually lead to more opportunities for them to create whatever. And that in itself will create probably more aesthetic value, whatever, religious value, whatever that is. And so they domineer every other factor of society. And that's where we are right now. Right. And
I heard what?
And that's pretty much what I was going to say.
I heard a great anecdote yesterday, or I guess it was an exchange between Howard Stern Hillary Clinton. So Howard Stern was talking about, this was about a year or 2 years ago, this interview. Uh-huh. Great, great fucking interview, by the way. If you want to like get an idea of what Hillary Clinton might be like as a real person, that's the interview. Because the fucking thing about Howard Stern is like he's the best at getting that, you know, natural out of a person, because he doesn't fucking care.
And
they're not going to leave, because if you walk out of Howard Stern's show, it's going to be all over the news that you're the asshole that
did. That's why I like him, though, is because he asks the questions that they don't want. He's chill. I know what he
But anyway, special. So Hillary Clinton, you would think, is somebody that's like a stone robot. You know, she's
stoic,
a robotic.
Yeah.
So she wrote this book with her daughter, Chelsea, I believe, about, I think it was like 10 women that are 10 incredibly strong women that are more underrated, like not the Oprahs and the Michelle Obamas of the world, but a few that are lesser known that need to be brought brought into the spotlight in her eyes, her and Chelsea's eyes. Howard Stern brings one up. I believe it was female astronaut, and I can't remember her name. But so what happened was she was a teacher that had a kid and won some sort of contest to be able to be on, I believe it was probably the Columbia that exploded, if I'm not mistaken. Spaceship. It was one of those spaceships. I'm pretty sure it was the Columbia. I'm probably wrong about that. It's in the 80s. Mm. So yeah, she won the competition, trained, you know, had the daughter. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure she was a single mom. And Howard Stern asked a question, something along the lines, which I thought was incredibly fucking ignorant to ask, especially ask Hillary Clinton.
Columbia disaster.
Oh, was it Columbia?
2003.
Okay.
February 1st, 2003.
Okay.
Was it really?
It might be
Columbia.
A different one.
This was the one in the 80s. Okay, I remember the Columbia.
This, this one says Space Shuttle Columbia.
Watch
disaster.
That shit live. Anyway, so she trains. She's accepted. Uh-huh. She's a single mother. And Howard Stern asks this incredibly ignorant or incredibly smart question. I don't think it was an incredibly smart question because I don't think Howard Stern is capable of, of manipulating a conversation that powerfully, especially to somebody like a politician. But then again, I'm going to shut my mouth here because he's been giving fucking interviews for the last, 30, 40 years. He's a New York expert. And he's incredibly smart. So what he says, the question is, do you think, to Hillary Clinton,
he's
he
like
says,
the best podcaster,
do you think it was irresponsible for her, the astronaut teacher, single mother, to go on that mission? And Hillary Clinton caught that, whether it was out of stupidity or expertise on behalf of Howard Stern, she caught it and she said, yeah, if all women were meant to do was raise kids after birth.
How do you respond?
And I was like, that's a cold-blooded fucking response and very true.
How do you respond?
That's how she responded.
But how did he respond to that?
He kind of just kept talking about something else.
Of course.
He didn't let it hit him.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what tells me that it might be like, you know, expertise. That's a tough question that could have caught her off guard and was towards the end of the interview where he had already built rapport, which is what a therapist would have done to challenge later on. But, you know, no, that was an incredibly great response in my opinion because that isn't all women are supposed to do is raise a fucking child. She can go to space if she wants.
She can
go to space if she wants. Yeah. She was a single mother or what was it again?
I think she was a single mother. I could be wrong about that, but that's what, at least from what I gathered from the interview, that's the information they were giving.
When did you say it was?
I think it was in the 80s.
Yeah. That's crazy.
The Columbia one was in 2003.
That's crazy. I know. That's so...
I'm just like... What's this one called now?
Yeah, no, sorry to drag that on.
I don't think that was a smart question. I mean, like Howard Stern. Maybe I'm in the minority here, but I don't like.
You are.
I don't know. I don't.
You don't like Howard Stern?
I used. I don't know. I just think it's just too. Maybe it's too authentic. I don't know. It's just like I feel
what
a lot of ugly shit gets on that show.
Say?
Huh?
What's
authenticity? Dude, it's like Joe Rogan.
Well, but it is.
Maybe it's scripted. You know, it's so maybe. Authentic that maybe it's almost scripted. Because I feel like that interchange between Hillary Clinton and Howard Stern, like that almost sounds like a
some
line.
Some things are set up. That's what I'm saying. Some things are like.
I mean, you got it. You had to see this. This was there. Was,
you know what I mean, though? Like
there was no way that was scripted.
No,
because if it was, they would have had to act it out a couple times. Yeah, but it was in the middle of like a commotion. You know,
I mean, really there's like way too much like noise going on that show.
That it's like CSI TV shows, and you're like, there's that suspense build for like Hillary Clinton.
Maybe Bailey's right about. Yeah, I personally think it was authentic, but it might be because we are also talking about Hillary Clinton.
That's yeah,
she's very, very, very close with the CIA. She's like,
yeah, I mean, like, she'll do her job to not be seen as you know bad. Yeah.
Can we take a quick break?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. You can tell her that I've gone to the midnight sun, when my days won't keep turning into nights. You can tell her that I've gone to a sassy shore, with a big ocean and a bottle to escape these lights. You can tell her that I've gone in a cloak of black. Tell her anything that's pleasing to her, but just don't tell her I miss her. Just don't tell her I miss her, but please don't tell her I miss her.
All right, we are back on Our Thoughts Tonight. So one thing while I was looking up Baudrillard was techno-romanticism. I found that which is a really interesting concept. Developed by Stefan Behrén, apparently, was the first to develop the concept of techno-romanticism. Techno-romanticism is a term used to indicate those aspects of contemporary culture that ascribe to advanced technologies the capacity to promote the power of the imagination, to restore the role of genius, and to bring about a unity, in other words, that revive and perpetuate the legacy of the 18th and 19th century. So I guess, so you know how romanticism, we're talking Chopin, and then artists, but that reminds me of something. The concept of those aspects of contemporary culture that ascribe to advanced technologies, in one way or another, I'm thinking about that, you know, OnlyFans, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you hear how they're no longer going to be pornographic?
I heard something was going on. I didn't know about that.
So that's their sole.
I guess it makes.
Yeah, I was like,
pretty much that most people use it for. Otherwise, it's like a shittier Patreon.
Yeah.
Like lots of people are going
to lose money. I'm thinking like there's some reality to this that. There's two things here for that. One thing is similar to the farming situation.
Yeah.
This was a form of a farming situation for women.
Right.
Even though it's unethical, I don't want to say unethical, but the fact that that women have to kind of sell their bodies or the visuals of their bodies is ridiculous, which some people make the argument like, well, women have it easier in capitalism. They could just, you know, get naked. But it's like, they could get naked. Like, that's not fucking humiliating for some people.
Yeah.
But it was a form.
For some people, it's not. Yeah, it's.
It is. Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't, like, as a man, I wouldn't fucking do it. I wouldn't be able to. But so what I'm thinking is there's some disconnect here. There's a reason why this is happening, obviously, because the people that are running the banks that aren't allowing OnlyFans to hold this type of content anymore within their website are likely rich white men that run the banks that back OnlyFans. So it made me think of your farm situation, and somehow that I was reminded of that by the techno-romanticism.
It starts out from this, you know, from this purpose, and then you get rid of the purpose, and now it's like, well, what is it now?
Yeah, what is it now? But also in the fact that, you know, you're robbing all of these women that are making shit tons of money now, and it's almost as if it's done on purpose. So to have this ease through the hyper real that women now had, I should say, they can't have it.
I think it's like,
no, it's not only Visa fans, it's
and
the
MasterCard
banks.
As the villain.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So the banks are the problem, but. Yeah. Somebody else is going to pick it up, and they're going to do it through blockchain.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the same thing. But for right now, you're stripping these women that have been stripped of so many other things throughout history of an easy way, you know, through this hyper real situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, it's like, you know, you create situations where, you know, women have to adapt, and then you kind of pull the rug out from the under.
Exactly.
You know? So it's like, well, it's really funny how you put it, like, you know, once you get, you know, with her history or whatever, the constant, you know, how should I say it? It starts from like equal roles to like, you know, the mother figure to this, this, and this, and then down to like, you know, the body, right? And then boom, get rid of that too, I suppose. At least in this, you know, capitalist way. But no. Yeah, that's insane. Do you want to say something else about the techno-romanticism thing?
Oh yeah, I recently bought this book. I haven't started reading it yet, but I vaguely know what it's about. And I don't know why I didn't think about bringing it or anything like that. Because this is 100% in line kind of with what we're talking about. It's called, it's from the 60s, I believe. It's called The Machine in the Garden.
I think I've heard of that.
And it's this kind of a critique, but it's by Leo Marx. And the description here is, "The Machine in the Garden fully examines the difference between the pastoral and progressive ideals which characterized in early 19th century American culture and which ultimately evolved into the basis for much of the environmental and nuclear debates of contemporary society." And he kind of mentions along the lines of like, if I'm not mistaken, an example he uses is like, I think it's in Huckleberry Finn, where they're on the boat, right?
Yeah.
The steamboat just happens to run through where they are so they can't pass by or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he uses that as an example of technology getting in the way of the pastoral idea that America was not necessarily like founded on, but now a technology-driven world is changing these ideals. And if I haven't read it, but that's what I'm gathering.
I want to say two things on that. One in agreement and one in disagreement. So in the agreement part, Not to be that guy again, but once again, Kaczynski. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, cities are built on roads.
Kaczynski, I bet you he was influenced by
this. No, I'm sure. I mean, Kaczynski is not original, but, you know, I think he talks about a lot of different stuff. But, I mean, the way the cities are structured is, you know, in the way of the pedestrian, which you can view as a pastoralist. But also, like, the way I would disagree with that maybe, though, is, like, at least with American cities and how they were originally built, and also states, they were very much trying to, again, going back to the whole manifest destiny and this perfect utopian society is like, for example, states were deliberately trying to be shaped by squares, and same with cities. They were traditionally, artificially trying to be made, right? Whether that's due to technology or not, if it's pre-industrial revolution, but I think I overall agree, but like, I think there's a lot of artificialness inherent to America. You know, maybe it's not just technological, but it's also like, you know, there is of course pastoralist roots in America, but it's also like utopian and, you know, maybe a little more inauthentic.
It says here,
once again, with the inherently patriarchal and white supremacist structures.
It says here that Marx isn't so much interested in historical changes to the physical landscape. Instead, he looks at the interior landscape, I guess he says, the landscape of the psyche. And it is intelligently and well-written literature that he believes offers us the most useful and insightful direct access to the psyche. While pop culture traded on puerile and sentimental pastoralism, that is, the simple and unreflective urge to find a middle ground between the over-civilization of the city and the violent uncertainties of nature. Serious literature took a hard, careful look at the contradictions in American culture, and particularly at the conflict between the old image of America and its new image as an industrial power.
Well, Kaczynski, the manifesto is ideally his PhD. I think his PhD was around that same time. He might have been reading him at the time, or something. Cool. I mean, that guy definitely wouldn't have read anything along the lines of Kaczynski at then. I'm interested in what you said about the whole mix between like the industrial order and like the chaotic pastoralism. Because, like, for example, if you view Europe, like most of Europe is one big, large mega city, right? I mean, like, you know, the Benelux region, and then like northern France, southern England, and also western Germany, they're all literally like one city, technically speaking. But with America, you do have mega cities, like, you know,
like one county.
Well, in America, for example, you have this, like, for example, the East Coast is basically our only real mega city between New York, Boston, the entire state of New Jersey. Like, it's basically like this one mega city, right? But it's all America really has. Like,
but it's also different at the same time, though. Accents are different.
Well, is that what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the actual blend, I guess, between like city order and industrial pastoralism, or sorry, chaotic pastoralism. With America, I guess you do kind of see that blend, I suppose, because you do have cities, obviously, but it's also like
counties.
There is some sort of, but at the same time, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, you don't really see that in like many other countries.
I'd like to know like where the line is too, where the rules are different. There's just different rules on different sides of the line. You know what I mean? Memorize all this like subconsciously. Yeah.
Some like, John Wayne shit. Yeah. Apparently,
John Wayne it up.
So the Kaczynski essay, the manifesto was from an essay that he wrote in 71.
Okay. Okay.
And then, you know, he finished it in 95 or something like that.
Okay. All right. Wow. So that's it's a few years. I'm sure you read it.
35,000 words. That's a book.
For who?
For the manifesto.
Really? It's a pretty short book. It's like 100 pages. I mean, from what I remember. I don't know. I haven't read it in a while. But, God.
Yeah.
It's genuinely creepy. And, like, maybe this is a closer, closer idea. Like, Baudrillard's, like, whole, what's the word? Advice for like this hyper real age is like you just gotta adapt because he basically says there's no turning back, like we're just gone.
And to think about turning back is almost worse, because then you become a Luddite and you're just like, oh, the guy that doesn't like technology, or whatever.
Yeah,
it's just fucking weird.
I mean, that's the thing, like the entire books, like Simulacrum and Simulation, felt like so post apocalyptic, but at the same time, like he's not like saying any of this is technically bad, he's just saying it's a really harsh change, you know, than what's usually been the case.
So sudden.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would go further than Baudrillard and say, like, we've been doing hyperreal stuff since, like, 10,000 years ago, but it's definitely been, like, accelerating to a point where it's like, well, where are we now?
Yeah. So. It's like that machine acceleration has really changed things.
The Terminator.
I was going to say, should we do final thoughts?
I mean, I had one final thought, So when I was reading, again, I keep mentioning this, but I ended up writing a quick paper just for myself, just to like get some ideas down. But I guess the whole idea that I was thinking, it was my own like impromptu late night idea of what's going on. Sorry. Was basically like, I think we've come to a point where we're sort of, I think, reverting back. How should I say it? Like, I mean, I don't want to get too in depth of what I was saying, but basically I was basically saying that like, if you consider human evolution, everything, and organisms and everything like that, you essentially start with the sort of solitude of the individual, right? And then eventually you get to the groups and the civilization and the hyper reality and stuff. But I think through the modern age, whether through capitalism or hyper reality or whatever, you kind of have a sort of reverse where there's solitude kind of coming back. But so much so because everything else is fake, and then people start questioning themselves, and there's a sort of like, the sort of nihilism that's going on.
Get them.
What? Yeah. So I feel like in a weird way, we're actually back to being authentic in the way we're truly authentic because we don't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
Like pure organism.
You've admitted it.
Yeah. Nobody like knows. Pure nihilism, pure whatever, just pure being, whatever. So in that way, I feel like maybe it's a disagreement with this Baudrillard, but maybe we've become so hyper-real, we've actually become so real where we actually don't know what to do now, because we're at that point where maybe we're the hyper-real ones and we're in a real, real situation and we don't know what to do. And I don't think that's, you know, contradictory to him maybe, but like we're definitely in a weird turning point, like mentally speaking. It's not really, it's a pure primal state of mind.
We're internally in a state of emergency.
Yeah, the whole idea of existential crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm going too much for final thoughts, but the whole idea of existential crisis, like when people had that back in the day, they were called prophets. Now everyone has an existential crisis.
Really?
I mean, like I'm kind of paraphrasing, but like the Buddha, for example, it's like,
oh yeah, yeah, you're yeah. Right,
I mean,
right.
Like you have
what? Did people not have existential crisis?
I'm sure they did, but like for example, it was seen maybe mostly because of writing or something, but like. People who had existential crisis and came up with whatever, they were considered like religious wise, like unique people. I'm sure everyone had them at one point, but it's like it was unique in a way, at least how I view it. But nowadays, everyone has everyone has existential crises, you know. So maybe it's a part of our age. Maybe I'm BSing, but I don't know.
I think you're making a good point.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point.
Like first human interaction. Like conversation that you have with somebody where
So
it's object.
I did have a question aside from that for you guys as my final thought. Where do you see the world technologically and societally 100 years from now?
Oh, that's some Black Swan stuff, right?
That's like the
speaking
show
of, yeah, the Black Obama, Swan.
We're go. All like in hamster tubes getting air suction from one place to another.
You think so?
Yeah.
So that's cars, but that's if you think about cars, it, that
spaceboards from Back to the Future.
You're talking about Futurama, right?
Yeah.
That is, it's like built off of a mid-century modern idea of what the future, like now, was supposed to look like.
Yeah.
It looks nothing like that.
I know it doesn't, but so, it's slowly evolving to be something like that because.
Well, that's what they thought.
That's what they thought then.
Yeah.
I know, but someone's already. That's what I'm saying, though.
The funny thing is, it looked more like the future than it does now.
It's a slow pasta cooking.
They wanted hamster tubes zooming you to one place to another, but here in the year 2000, we got fucking stainless steel fridges.
I don't exactly. You're right. I'm not saying that.
What a letdown.
I'm not saying that it's happening right now. I'm just saying that it's slowly evolutionized. Like,
yeah, I'm sure maybe one day we'll get there. Yeah.
No, I'm not. I'm not saying we're gonna have fucking hamster tubes everywhere. I'm saying that there is gonna be hoverboards. There is going to be hoverboard cars. Yeah. There already is. Yeah. There's things that are like that.
Just if they will get popular.
There's like water ski jet packs and shit like that. And then there's like real jet packs that you played in San Andreas.
So you think those are going to be more common?
Oh, if you got enough money now, you can come to space if you want. It'll become normal class. It'll become middle class. Before that, conditioned. I'm making sure the door is fucking locked because I'm supposed to always make sure the door is fucking locked. Can you? And I already have the handle open and I'm reaching for his fucking doorknob on the inside. Birds could do it, and that's a fucking thing. To nuclear warfare, to just wars in itself for no fucking reason. But from 1993 for me up until now, there's been a fucking huge PC that had no internet connection. An MSN when it was cool. From MySpace to Facebook to fucking people texting on phones from mobile phone.
Yeah.
And trying to describe what's authentic.
That was our thoughts tonight.
All right, everybody. We'll see everybody in the next episode.
Bye. Millionaires are scary. Billionaires are even scarier.
Dun, dun, dun.
The new song by Bob Dylan. Tambourine man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning I'll come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. Weariness amazes me, I'm branded on my feet. I have no one but me, and my ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Then take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped, my hands can't feel to grip, my toes are numb to step, and only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere, I'm ready for it to fade into my own parade. Cast your dance and spell my way, I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning I'll come following you. Though you like your life in spinning, swinging madly across the sun, it's not aimed at anyone, it's just escaping on the run. And but for the sky there are no fences facing. And if you hear vague traces of skipping rails of rhyme to your tambourine in time, it's just a ragged clown behind. I wouldn't pay it any mind, since the shadow that you're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man. disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind. Down the foggy roads of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sight.